Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines. It's time to get revved up for sports, and guess what? More sports on the RPM Roundtable Podcast with Robin Clark, Paul McGaughey, and Mike Sesney.
Welcome to the RPM Roundtable Podcast. It's Thursday, March 28th. I'm here with Robin and Mike. As usual, we're in the studios at Centennial College in Toronto. We have breaking news from last night. When I went to bed, it looked as though Jerome Iginla was on his way to Boston, as Iginla had been pulled from the Flames lineup and a couple prospects were pulled from the Bruins lineup. But when I woke up this morning, I was informed that Iginla had been traded to the Pittsburgh Penguins. A breakdown of that deal. Obviously, the Penguins get Iginla, and on the way to Calgary are two college prospects, Kenneth Augustino and Ben Hanowski. And the Calgary Flames also get the Penguins' first-round pick this season. Just a quick breakdown of the college prospects headed to Calgary. Hanowski is 22 and is in his fourth year at St. Cloud State. That's in Minnesota. He was drafted in the third round by Pittsburgh in 2009 and has 16 goals and 29 points in 34 games. The other player, Augustino, a forward in his third year at Yale, was Pittsburgh's fifth-round pick in 2010, 15 goals and 37 points in 33 games. First of all, Robin, if you're a Calgary Flames fan, are you excited at all about this deal?
Not particularly, to be honest. I don't think either of the guys going over are particularly big-time prospects or anything like that. And the other thing to consider is that people hear first-round pick and they assume, okay, we're going to be getting a superstar player. But in this case, Pittsburgh is probably going to finish... I think now people are saying they're pretty much a lock for the Cup, so this is not going to be a good first-round pick. I would have liked to see Calgary get an actual top prospect and maybe a good player off the roster of Pittsburgh. So no, I don't think Calgary fans really have anything to be excited about. The only potential good thing about this, in my opinion, is that it's signaling the start of the rebuild in Calgary, which has been needed for probably the last 4 or 5 years. What do you think, Mike?
Well, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think Calgary has, you know, they might finish in a lottery position this year. So they're going to have potentially two picks in the first round, one of which is going to be maybe in the top five somewhere. I think this is a well-needed rebuild for Calgary. But I think, honestly, it's about 6 years too late with all the run-ins with Olli Jokinen and Lee Stempniak and whoever else they could scrap together to put a lineup out there. And I don't know. I think for Jerome Iginla, I think he's finally – it's kind of bittersweet, I guess, for him because he obviously loved playing in Calgary, but they never could give him any players to play with. And he wanted to finish his career there. But unfortunately, they finally need to rebuild, and him going to Pittsburgh, obviously, he's probably thrilled with the lineup he gets to play with. Actually, just offhand, who do you think he's going to be paired up on a line with?
I'll just jump in there for a second. Iginla played 15 seasons with Calgary, was in the last year of his deal, so he's essentially a rent-a-player for Pittsburgh. Robin, what do you think as far as him fitting into the lineup there? They have obviously a lot of names with Crosby and Malkin. Where does
right.
he fit in?
Well, see, that's the thing. It's Pittsburgh needs to make a decision on whether you value line chemistry more or basically putting a bunch of superstar names together to see how they can produce. Because right now you've got Crosby between Chris Kunitz and Pascal Dupuis, and they're the highest scoring line in the NHL by far. And I don't know how you can break that up. So I think the best fit would be to put Iginla on a line on the second line with Malkin and James Neal.
Yeah, I agree. When Malkin returns from injury,
right
now I think Dustin Jeffries centering that line, and Morrow looks like he's slotted in on the second line already. But, I mean, you could probably move Morrow down to the third line with Brandon Sutter, and depending on who they decide to move out there, Matt Cook or Tyler Kennedy, and then have a second line of Neil Aginla and Dustin Jeffrey, which is could be a first line on any other team. So Pittsburgh's definitely got, they're rolling four scoring lines pretty much. That's, and then that's the name of their game this year. They're just trying to outscore their opponents. But the pickup of obviously Douglas Murray last, or was that this week?
I think it was at the end of last, or it was over the weekend.
Okay,
it was over
yeah,
the weekend.
Over the weekend. So yeah, they're definitely shoring themselves up for a playoff run. And right now they look potentially like the favorite coming out of the East, I would say.
This also pisses me off because now nothing is going to happen on trade deadline day.
Yeah.
Like, even less so than the previous years where it's been god-awful until about 3 o'clock when the deals start pouring in. And now, you know, breaking news is going to be a depth forward traded for a fourth-round pick.
Yeah,
so
it's funny you say that because I say the same thing, but I wake up every year.
Oh, as do I, yeah.
I don't know why I put myself through it, but...
So just one final note on Aginla, 9 goals, 13 assists in 31 games. Less pressure for him in Pittsburgh, do you think? A big weight off his shoulders getting out of Calgary and maybe rejuvenated by the fresh start? What do you guys think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he doesn't need to be the number one scorer there. He's got, there's tons of guys ahead of him. And for a guy that's probably kind of winding down in his career, he's not going to have to do as much skating as he normally would in Calgary, which is probably good for him. And like I mean, I kind of see him kind of like Danny Heatley, where the skating is kind of regressing, and they're gonna be there. They can still, you know, have those snipes and take those shots and get the goals. Like they're still clutch shooters. So
I can't wait to see that first power play unit when everyone's healthy, which probably will look like Crosby, Malkin, and Neil up front. And I wouldn't be. Or I'd be surprised, sorry, if Aginla wasn't playing the back end with Chris Letang. I think that would be pretty cool to watch.
Overall, the Pittsburgh Penguins have won 13 games in a row. They're on a roll. Crosby's leading the league in points with 54. What do you guys think of Crosby's performance this year leading that team?
Well, he's obviously the best player in the game right now. And I will never deny his talent. I do take slight issue with Sidney Crosby. That's well documented. Mostly for his whining to the referees every time something happens. He's always looking at them as soon as he gets knocked down. And just the fact that I think it was last year when he came back from concussion, the first time, I believe, or the second time. And he had just been out for so long with a head injury, and the first thing he does against the Senators is he elbows Nick Foligno in the head. I don't know. I think sometimes he's such a talented guy, but he's such a whiner, and I don't know. I think he doesn't want people to do that to him, but he has no problem going out there and, you know, bashing someone in the head with his elbow, which is, you know, trying to induce the same injury he just was on the shelf for a year.
I don't buy it. I think that's the most overblown, ridiculous thing ever. Here's a guy who, as you said, is clearly the best player in the league, and no one can stay with him on the ice. So, yeah, does he complain a lot to the ref? Sure, but he gets hacked and slashed and, you know, fouled, if you will. I'm going to take an example just from soccer right now. As everyone probably knows, there's two players in soccer, Ronaldo and Messi, who are miles ahead of everyone else, and they get the same flack for complaining. But it's like no one can stay with them. They get fouled so much, and after a while, enough is enough. And so I think that thing about Crosby, I don't think it's fair, and I think it's overblown.
I just think it's an entitlement issue. I think that he knows he's the best player, and he thinks that he's untouchable. And that's what I – like, I mean, that was just like Gretzky when Gretzky played. He did the same thing.
Yeah.
And we all know the high-sticking incident, so we don't really need to look for any other example. But, yeah, I don't know. Crosby just – he just bugs me. He bugs me, and it's not because he's the best player and he's not playing on a team I like, you know. It's just, I don't know. I can't stand the fact that he knows he's the best, and then he has this sense of entitlement. Every time somebody touches him, he has to cry to the ref right away. John Tortorella was right about the Pittsburgh Penguins when he made that comment about their two top stars whining over there. I thought that was excellent.
Also, if you're looking for a robotic statement in a post-game news conference, Crosby is your guy.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't like him. That's the end of the story.
One more question, and then we'll leave the Pittsburgh topic. If the Penguins met the Blackhawks in the Stanley Cup Final, who wins that series?
That's a tough one.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, I guess it depends on what the Blackhawks do at the trade deadline. But I think goaltending-wise and defense, the Blackhawks definitely win in those two categories for me. But offensively, I don't know.
I like Pittsburgh. People say Fleury's unproven, and yeah, that Flyers series was a little bit ridiculous. But I think overall he's shown enough to, you know, show that he's an elite goaltender, and I like Pittsburgh's chances. I don't see a lot of holes on the team. The other thing I think we just need to mention about this trade is that it appeared as though Iginla was on his way to Boston, and it was reported by different news agencies such as TSN, where Iginla was a healthy scratch last night in Calgary's game against Colorado. And then we also found out that a few of Boston's top prospects were scratched, and so people put one and one together and thought that. And it's actually interesting. There's some tweets from Bob McKenzie that say, "To be clear, no excuses. Our group at TSN, of which I'm a part of, regrets making a reporting error tonight. Apologies to our audience. That said, we have an outstanding group at TSN, second to none, and we'll move forward to do a great job for our viewers, listeners, readers. And so I've never seen anything like that. I haven't seen TSN drop the ball like that, and I guess they're being accountable, so that's all you can ask for.
Yeah, at first I thought that was funny when you read it, but now I'm thinking, I'm wondering if that's even necessary to apologize for.
I think now it is in today's age. I mean, with Twitter, people were probably just waiting there, you know, foaming out the mouth to get on one of them for screwing that up. So I think the apology definitely.
But does that break your trust with TSN as far as being hockey insiders and reporting deals?
No, and I think that's why they issued the apology. They're still the best at it, in my opinion. So
yeah, I totally agree with that. I also think that, I mean, if you are annoyed by this, then you got some bigger issues. But yeah, a lot of people went to bed thinking that he was a member of the Boston Bruins, and I don't think that this story broke until 2 or 3 in the morning, so most people saw it this morning.
It broke for me at about 9:55 a.m.
Yeah, there you go. So
no, I'm definitely going to cut them some slack on this one. When we come back, the RPM Roundtable, we'll talk about Toronto Maple Leafs. The Maple Leafs are currently sixth in the Eastern Conference with a record of 18-12-4. And if the playoffs started today, they would face the third-place Winnipeg Jets. Mike, how do you feel about the Leafs holding on and making the playoffs this season?
I feel pretty good. I think they're going to make the playoffs this year. I don't think the teams underneath them are going to be able to catch up just based on how bad their play has been in the past. Overall in the season. I mean, Philly was a team that people thought would do a lot better. I even at the start of the year when we did our analysis after the first week, I definitely thought Philly was going to make a comeback and the Rangers as well. But the one thing we were right about, I guess, is that the Islanders were kind of going to be out of it. However, they've also sort of hung on. So I think for the Leafs, they have 14 games remaining. We're looking for about a 500 performance from them, and they should possibly still make the playoffs. I think the Sports Club Stats website has them at a 94% chance of making the playoffs. And just looking here right now, if they go one game above 500 during this final stretch, they have a 99.9% chance of making the playoffs. So it's looking good for Leafs Nation. I think the drought could be over, and I also could be jinxing them right now. So with my luck, that's probably what's going to happen.
I totally agree. I had them at the start of the year either just missing out or squeaking in, and I think that's still probably what they'll do. The other teams, I'm shocked at the Flyers and Rangers. I don't think anyone saw that coming. I'd also like to point out that I had the Jets winning that division, and I know they're not in yet, but I've been really impressed by the Jets recently. I don't think that's a particularly good matchup for the Leafs in the first round of the playoffs. I think in terms of their strengths, they'd almost rather face the Habs as a 1-8, 2-7, whatever the case may be. I think it would also make for a great matchup.
Yeah, and the way it's looking right now is that if even though the Leafs have more points than the Jets, if they have to play Winnipeg in their building because Winnipeg wins the Southeast Division, that's going to be potentially a problem for Toronto in the first round, given that they didn't play very well in that building over the course of the season.
They haven't even played Winnipeg well at home.
Yeah, that's true
so
as well.
So I don't like that matchup at all. I think, obviously, the Habs bounced back last time after getting embarrassed on home ice near the start of the season, but I think that's a much better matchup for the Leafs.
As a side note, I never like seeing Canadian teams play each other in the first round because that means one of them is obviously gone.
Yeah, me too. Unless it's Montreal, they're just a European expansion team anyways.
I don't even know what to say to that.
That's just my two cents. That's my Don Cherry moment of the day.
Ah, there you go. New segment.
Yeah. No, I mean, the other thing, too, with Toronto the other day, Lupo got moved up to the first line. I think that's some good... They're showing some good flexibility there with being able to move either Van Riemsdyk up or Lupo up and the other down or vice versa. Both of them can obviously score, and I think it was a move by Carlisle to kind of spark Van Riemsdyk, because it seems like anybody he puts with Kadri right now is starting to produce. Even your good old buddy Nikolai Kulamin.
Yeah.
There, Robin.
I know.
So he's got, what has he got now? I think a couple goals in the last
I think
games.
He has 2 goals in his last 3 games.
Yeah.
And before that he had 2 in his previous, what, 27 or something like that? So
yeah. I think they're doing they're finally able to roll like 3 good scoring lines and not a third shutdown unit that can't even score with Colby Armstrong on it. So, yeah.
The goal scoring is definitely encouraging. I was looking at Lupo's numbers from last season. Before his injury, he had 67 points in 66 games. This season, he has 6 goals in 5 games since returning from injury. Where do you rank him? Not just on the Leafs, but overall in the league as a talented forward.
Well, he's a top 6 forward for sure.
On the Leafs or in the league?
I would say on any team he'd probably be a top 6 forward.
Right.
I don't know. I guess it's hard to say with the injuries where to put him, but this like outburst of production's obviously pretty impressive. And if it wasn't for the suspension, I think he'd be carrying that goal streak. However, I don't think it counts on the record book because of the suspension. So,
well, yeah, that's the thing, right? He was always a really talented player. They had a really great group in back in Philadelphia before when he was there with guys like Scotty Upshaw, whose career also was ruined by injury and hasn't really got it back. But Anaheim's got to be kicking themselves. I know Beauchemin has played well, but they refused to use Lupo on the left side. And, yeah, I mean, they should have tried, because that's where he's been and that's where he's been successful. And never mind Gardner. Lupo for Beauchemin, 1-for-1, is a bad trade, so...
Yeah, definitely a good pickup for the Leafs. Let's just talk about Jay Gardner for a second. He's played 5 games since being recalled. I was looking over his numbers last night, and the word that jumped out at me was underwhelming. Mike, what do you think of his performance so far?
Yeah, I think I said this last week a bit. I mean, he just tries to do too much, it seems, and I don't want to say he's in a sophomore slump, because he's probably played like what is it, 8 games now with the Leafs this season. So, but you can tell he's sort of struggling. That goal on that was kind of on him the other night when they played Florida to, I think it was tie the game after Lupo just scored the go-ahead. And I don't know. For me, the only thing that stands out is the fact that if Holzer was still on this team and he did something like that, the Twitter universe would just blow up on it, on him. And I just think people kind of baby Gardner and kind of give him a bit more credit than he deserves at this point in his career.
I'm going to throw something out there that a lot of people aren't going to find popular, but is Jake Gardner the defenseman version of Matthew Lombardi? Because to this point in his career, I honestly think, and with Lombardi, he was great in Calgary, he got injured, fair enough. But I almost think that in a case like that, a guy's ability to skate just makes him not work on other parts of his game. And to me, Jake Gardner appears to be doing just that. Yeah, he can fly, and it's amazing to watch him skate, but I don't think other parts of his game are necessarily at a high NHL level, and so I'd like to see him do other things instead of just flying up and down the ice. Because, yeah, you can jump into the play, and if you're a good skater, you can get back, but that's not always going to be the case, and it's going to cost you.
Yeah, he finds himself pinching a lot, but I think for him it's also the puck-moving ability. Like, he has he does a very good job of getting the puck out of their zone, I think, on just being able to outskate people and then make that first pass. But then again, sometimes you can see the rookie in him make those mistakes, which is, I guess, part of the growing pains, you can say. But I think that just with coaching and over time, he'll stop jumping in on every single rush opportunity.
Next up on the RPM Roundtable, I will present the Man of the Week. This article appeared in the Wednesday, March 27th edition of the Toronto Star. The Lee Valley Iron Pigs are taking extreme games to an entirely new level. The Pennsylvania-based AAA affiliate for the Philadelphia Phillies will be the first team in North America to include pee-controlled video gaming in men's washrooms when the season opens next week. The Iron Pigs announced that unique flow-controlled gaming experience will be available at Coca-Cola Park on opening day, April 4th. Fans who use the urinals will be able to compete against other flow-goers for the top score and the chance to hold the Flow King crown. Developed by United Kingdom-based Captive Media, the video console flips into gaming mode when a user approaches the urinal, and by means of patented technology, detects both his presence and stream. Algorithms allow the user to engage with the screen by aiming in different directions to test agility and knowledge. A number of games are planned for the 2013 season, including alpine skiing, which allows users to speed his way through snowy mountains while attempting to hit cartoon penguins. I'm sorry.
Is this a joke?
Yes, this is for real. The games will rotate throughout the season, and highest scores will be displayed in real time around the stadium. Ladies and gentlemen, the Lee Valley Iron Pigs are our Men of the Week. Welcome back to the RPM Roundtable. We are now going to do our final installment of our MLB preview. This week we're looking at the AL East. We saved the best for last, in our opinion. Last season, the New York Yankees won the division with a record of 95-67. The Baltimore Orioles finished second and were the wild card team with a record of 93-69. The Tampa Bay Rays were 90-72, so you had three teams there with over 90 wins. The Toronto Blue Jays were in fourth with a record of 73-89. And in the basement, the Boston Red Sox were 69-93. First of all, I'm curious to hear how you guys think the division will play out this year as far as the standings.
Well, for me, I had the Blue Jays finishing first, then the Tampa Bay Rays, then the Boston Red Sox, then the Baltimore Orioles, and then finally the Yankees at the bottom.
The Yankees in the basement, wow.
Yeah, I think the injuries will just be too much to overcome.
From first to worst.
I've got something similar, but not quite the same. So I've got it going Jays, Red Sox, Rays, Yankees, and Baltimore. So also from a big fall from second in the division to last. So
the two playoff teams are going to be in the basement this year.
Yeah.
And sorry, Mike, where did you have Baltimore finishing?
I believe I had them in fourth.
Okay, so you both have them in the basement, just flipped. So let's start. I actually want to start with the Yankees. Why are they going to fall down that much? Why do you guys have so little confidence in their team this year?
Well, I mean, just like I said, I think the injuries will be too much for them. Teixeira is on the shelf. A-Rod's not playing for them anymore. Third base, he might not even play for them. I believe they're trying to somehow get his contract off the books.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck, exactly. Curtis Granderson's going to start the year on the DL. I don't see enough talent there. Jeter's getting up there in age. I believe he's also starting the season on the DL for them. And their pitching staff is pretty weak after Sabathia. I know Kuroda was a pretty good pitcher last year, but if he can repeat that, I don't know. Pettit's obviously aging. Phil Hughes has never really been a very good pitcher.
He's also hurt.
Yeah, and as a number five, maybe he's okay. And Ivan Nova, I could argue he'd probably be their second best pitcher with Pineda out, but he's going to pitch in the five spot in their rotation. Their bullpen's pretty decent, but Rivera's going to be retiring at the end of this year, as everyone knows. And I don't know, I just think that the age has finally caught up with them, and they didn't really spend that much money this offseason, whether or not that's a direct relation to the A-Rod contract holding them up. I don't know.
And Robin, I'm wondering if you could just touch a bit on some of their off-season moves. They recently picked up former Blue Jays Vernon Wells and Lyle Overbay.
Well, yeah, that's the thing that I was actually looking at. I mean, if you look at the names that are going to be in their opening day lineup, you've got Vernon Wells, Lyle Overbay, Francisco Cervelli, Edward Nunez, Travis Hafner, and Kevin Youkilis. So these are not your typical Yankees. And as Mike was saying, there's no Granderson, no Teixeira, and no A-Rod. And with two of those three guys in Teixeira and A-Rod, you, A, have no idea when they're coming back, and B, you don't have a clue what you're going to get from either of those guys when they do come back. So they're obviously a lot weaker. I think a lot needs to go right for the Yankees to stay in contention, but I think there is the potential for those things to go right. If Travis Hafner can stay even remotely healthy, he'll be starting the year as their DH. I think he is going to feast on the short right field porch. He's one of the most powerful guys I've ever seen. You've also got a guy like Kevin Youkilis on a one-year deal. Some people think he's done. Some people think he can put it together, and he's probably playing for a multi-year deal, the last contract he'll sign in his career. People like to make fun of the Vernon Wells acquisition. I don't mind it. The guy hit 25 home runs 2 years ago, and he hit 11 in under 250 at-bats last year. So the power's still there. The balls fly out of Yankee Stadium, and you could do a lot worse. He doesn't get on base, which is the biggest knock against him, but I don't mind the signing. I think this team will honestly go as far as the pitching carries them. So CC needs to be good. Pettit needs to stay healthy. There's no way Kuroda repeats what he does last year at age 36 or 37, but I think that if they can get half-decent pitching, they'll be okay, around 500, I would say.
The other team that we had finishing towards the bottom of the standings were the Baltimore Orioles. Do you guys think they were a fluke last year? And before I get to that, I just want to point out, I was looking at their depth chart at pitching, and the number one guy they have is Jason Hamill. He's 31 years old. He's 6'6", 225, so he's a big guy. But he's bounced around. He's played with Tampa and Colorado. In 2011, he was 7-13. Last season, he goes 8-6. So if that's the top pitcher on your depth chart, what does that say about their team right now?
That they're going nowhere fast, basically. I mean, yeah, Hamill was good last year until he got hurt. I remember actually after a game in Toronto, he gave up 4 home runs. It was one of his worst starts of the year, and he accused the Jays of stealing signs. And it's like, come on, you're a journeyman pitcher whose best season before last year was 10-8 with a 4.33 ERA. So no, I don't think that this team has the pitching. I don't understand why everyone thinks they're going to be good. They have one guy in the rotation who has a career ERA of under 4, and 3 of the 5 have career ERAs approaching 5. So that's not going to get it done in the AL East. They also had a 29-9 record in one-run games. And this is that's the stat that's out there and people look at. They were 74-0 with the lead after 7 innings. Totally unsustainable. 100%. And their closer, Jim Johnson, last year came out of nowhere to save 51 games. So I don't think Baltimore is good at all. I would be shocked if they finished 500. They've got a few nice pieces. Adam Jones is good. But other than that, I don't think Baltimore is good.
Yeah, I think for me, it's going to be those one-run games that make the difference. If they can repeat that, they're going to have the same success they had last year. If they can't, which I don't think they will, they're not going to do as well. Those one run games, you can't sustain that kind of record on one run games for that span of time. I don't think it's going to happen. So
that's just an incredible stat. And they had the best bullpen in the American League last year.
Yep,
isn't that correct? And so that's putting a lot of pressure on that bullpen to do well again this year.
And see, people read into the record in one-run games or the record after 7 innings and throw out all this nonsense about, oh, yeah, you can really tell that they came together as a team and blah, blah, blah. No, they had a good bullpen. They were incredibly lucky in those one-run games, had good pitching, and they had a career year from a guy that no one's ever heard of. I don't think Jim Johnson will get 40 saves. I'm not even sure he'll get 30 saves. Like, everything went right for Baltimore last year.
Robin, so you have the Red Sox finishing in second place in the division. Why is that? What do you like about this team? And do you think if they finish second that they would have a chance at the wild card in the AL?
I don't see them with a chance for the wild card, no. I like their chances for second in the division. I think there are potentially 3 teams in the AL West, in the Angels, A's, and Rangers, who will be better, but I don't think the AL East is the best division anymore, and so I like their signings. Victorino had a down year, but is still a good player. They also added Mike Napoli and Johnny Gomes. These aren't star players, so I think if they do decently well, then the Red Sox will be fine. And even though they had seemingly all of their pitchers have down years last year, John Lester is still a top pitcher in the AL, and they need a bounce back from guys like Buck Holtz, John Lackey, and Ryan Dempster. So stuff does need to go right, and it would help if David Ortiz recovered quickly, but I like their signings. They didn't go out and make a big splash by signing a Hamilton or a Pujols or whoever, but those guys are quietly good players.
Mike, how do you see the Red Sox doing this year? You have them finishing in third.
Yeah, I think the Rays are just going to be a better team overall. They always seem to outperform them. But Boston, however, for them to have things go right, I think is, just to add to what Robin said, the rotation. If I don't have much faith in Felix DuBrant, but he's the fifth starter. But Buchholz, obviously, we know he has the stuff. Same with Lester. They've proven it before. They've just had a couple terrible years. And if they can refine their game, they're going to be a pretty good rotation. Also, the bullpen and closer Joel Hanrahan, that was a very good pickup for them. He's definitely a proven closer, and they have an all-star, former all-star closer in Andrew Bailey right behind him, who suffered through injury last year, but if he returns healthy, he can definitely make a difference for them. So, yeah, I think Boston will finish third.
So let's talk a little bit about the Rays. They always seem to get it done with pitching. Robin, do they still have enough depth in their starting rotation to get them 90 wins like they had last season?
I'm not sure that they do. I don't think that the James Shields trade was great for them. I think Kansas City using him as a number one pitcher is a mistake, but I thought that he was a good fit right behind Price for the Rays. I think that having Jeremy Hellickson as a number two starter puts a lot of pressure on him, and that conversely puts a lot of pressure on Matt Moore, who really struggled last year and is having trouble finding the plate in the spring. I think the pieces are there in Tampa Bay: Joyce, Jennings, Longoria, obviously, and Ben Zobrist. But then you've got a couple of Jays rejects on the middle of the infield in Kelly Johnson and Escobar. And, I mean, I think it'll be close between the Rays and Red Sox, but I think ultimately the Tampa pitching isn't as strong as it has been, and I think that Boston has the ability with their lineup to score more runs than the Rays do. And speaking of flukes, we were touching on Jim Johnson before. Fernando Rodney, what he did last year with his, 1.3 ERA or whatever it was, and all of those saves after basically being released by the Tigers and Angels and not even having the faith of the team to be a setup man coming out of nowhere. I think counting on that is unrealistic.
Yeah, the rotation's got a lot of question marks for me, but I think if Cobb can put it together as well, last year, if you discounted the two games that he had 8-run stinkers, his ERA would have been 3.22, which is a stat I'm looking at right here. Will Myers is going to have to put it together for them in the outfield in his first rookie season. Whether or not that happens or not. Actually, this is an interesting stat I just looked at when you mentioned Yunel Escobar. I believe he has the third most hits while playing shortstop since 2008 behind Jeter and Jose Reyes. So I thought that was kind of interesting, but for him, I don't know. I mean, he's so off and on because I think he gets in his own head a lot, and when stuff kind of ticks him off, he becomes a terrible hitter all of a sudden, and he swings at everything, so I don't know. I still think they have a good lineup, and they're probably going to finish second. And I believe they could challenge the Jays for first in the division. It's just that Tampa Bay thing. I don't know what it is. It doesn't matter who's playing there. Joe Maddon has a good way of pulling out the best in everybody. So
I was just going to say that. I don't necessarily buy into. I think managers get too much blame and too much credit. That's a discussion for another day. But there does seem to be something with Maddon. So can't discount that.
Finally, the Toronto Blue Jays, who you both have finishing first. And I want to frame the discussion this way. As we mentioned, they won 73 games last year. Let's assume that, last year 95 wins won the division. Did they do enough this offseason to buy themselves 22 more victories than they had last year?
Yeah, I think they have the best rotation in baseball right now. Picking up Dickey obviously solidified that. The fact that they have Morrow, Josh Johnson, and Mark Burley in that rotation, and the only argument all spring was on the fifth starter, which is whenever you head into a season where that's your only problem, you're in pretty good shape. And as well. I think the only other problem too in camp was the second base issue, which has been resolved anyways due to Lori's injury. I believe they're going to platoon Esteris and Mark DeRosa at third base while playing Bonifacio at second in the short term. We'll see. I mean, that's going to be an emerging thing for them, is who's going to play second base, either Bonifacio or Esteris. But I believe they're just going to wait till Lori's back to solve that issue.
I'm going to talk about, not about the new acquisitions, which everyone knows about. I'm going to make a bold prediction, probably more bold than last week when I said that Justin Upton will win the NL MVP this year. I'm going to say that Josh Johnson will be the AL Cy Young winner and the first $200 million pitcher in baseball. And it's not going to happen with Toronto, so enjoy him for one season. I think the guy's motivated. The first interview with his agent here, he said he wants the money. He's not going to give the Jays any type of hometown discount. And I think he's going to have a huge season and ultimately be the number one or number two starter in the rotation. In terms of things that could go wrong for the Jays, I'd like to see Reyes play on the turf and see how he holds up. And obviously, I don't have high expectations for Melky Cabrera. I think the last two seasons have been, you know, I'm not going to say a fluke, but they were aided by some PEDs. So I think that's what could go wrong for the Jays. Other than that, I don't see any holes. I think the closer battle will settle itself, and things that people aren't talking about, contract years for Lind and Rasmus, always has increased production. So I think this team will be great to watch and do really well.
For me, actually, the thing that I'm worried about mostly is just the bullpen. Don't necessarily agree with Brett Cecil being there, but I understand he's out of options. Even though they always say we're not going to look at who has options, they always do. Him and you want to cheer for a guy like Jeremy Jeffress to find the strike zone because he throws 100 miles an hour, and you can't teach that kind of stuff. So, you know, you can teach finesse, but you can't teach a guy to throw that hard. So I think people want him to succeed. The other thing is J.P. Arencibia catching R.A. Dickey. I'm not necessarily a big fan of having him as the opening day catcher. I understand why they're doing it. It's kind of a pat on the head sort of thing to have him start opening day, but I don't know. To me, I've seen JP catch enough to know that he's going to have a lot of trouble with the knuckleball. I don't care how much he worked on it all off season. I don't think it's going to be a good thing, but we'll see.
I think I just want to end off talking about Jose Bautista, who I think this team is built around. And I don't think he's been a huge part of the storyline this offseason because of all the moves that they made and the question marks at the back end of the rotation. But I'm just curious to hear what you guys think. Does this team basically go as Bautista goes this year as far as his offensive production?
I don't necessarily think so. I think more so than any other year, he doesn't need to be the guy who's hitting 300 with 40 home runs or whatever the case may be. There's lots of guys. I don't think there's any chance Encarnacion repeats last year. That's not realistic, but I think there's lots of pieces. Bautista needs to rebound, but I think there's lots of help for the first time in a while, and Anthopoulos finally lived up to his promise of getting Bautista some players when he signed the extension.
And that concludes our MLB preview on the RPM Roundtable.
Thank you for listening to the RPM Roundtable Podcast.